Shrink Wrap Radio number 436, Brain, Mind, and Body in the Healing of Trauma, with Dr. Bessel van der Kolk.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
On today's show, I'll be speaking with noted psychiatrist Bessel van der Kolk, whose innovative work to integrate mind, brain, body, and social connections in the healing of trauma has had a profound impact on the care and treatment of trauma victims all over the world. We'll be discussing his new book, The Body Keeps the Score. For more information about Dr. van der Kolk, please see our show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Bessel van der Kolk, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. I am thrilled to have you on the show, and I'm looking forward to speaking with you about your new book, The Body Keeps the Score. And I think we have something in common in as much as you developed many of your ideas drawing upon your experiences working with veterans in the VA after the Vietnam War. And as it happens, I did internships at two different VA hospitals in Michigan during the mid-1960s, and so had some experience with the same population that you write about.
Good, yeah. Those are the guys who teach us.
Yeah, right. And I don't think PTSD even existed as a term.
Oh, certainly not in the mid-60s. That didn't come about till 1980.
Yeah.
Even after that, it took a while before it started to get utilized.
Yeah. And mostly, I think when we hear the term PTSD, I think the image that comes into most people's mind is that of soldiers damaged by war. But you say in your book that trauma is ubiquitous in our society. So what's behind that statement?
Well, for every soldier who gets PTSD from the war, there's about 30 kids who develop some sort of toxic stress from child abuse and neglect. For every soldier who gets killed in the war zones, there's at least one woman who gets killed by her boyfriend or husband. More kids get killed by handguns than get killed by leukemia. So trauma is pervasive in our society.
Yeah, these are sad statistics.
Yeah.
And that raises the question, does everyone who experiences trauma develop PTSD?
Well, you know, PTSD is just a list of symptoms developed by various committees over time. And so there is no such thing as PTSD except that it sort of captures what people suffer from to a greater or lesser degree. So people are more or less affected by trauma.
Okay, so some are more affected than others.
You know, with the population I treat, I never sit in my office and think, oh, how could this person possibly have developed PTSD in response to this? Anybody else could deal with that. My response is always, oh my God, how did you survive? How did you go on? And
So...
Horrendous things happen to people all the time.
Right. Now, what do we know about those who don't develop the symptoms of what we call PTSD, those who are in fact subjected to some sort of traumatic type experiences but don't develop it? Do we know anything about that process?
Well, see, again, the interesting thing is how people survive and not whether they... You know, we don't know about people who don't come to our attention. There's very pervasive post-traumatic stress in our population, and it's actually much more interesting to talk about what effect it has on people than speculating about who might not develop it after a gang rape or after seeing your kid being killed by a sniper or something like that. That's not so interesting. The issue is that there's millions of people who suffer from it, and that's the people we need to help.
Yeah. So what led you to write your book, The Body Keeps the Score?
What led me to write it? Well, many different things. One is that the issue of how pervasive trauma is throughout psychiatric diagnosis and throughout suffering is not very widely known. That's one thing. The other thing is that psychologists tend to believe in the infinite capacity of talk to resolve things. Psychiatrists tend to resolve the infinite capacity of drugs to solve things. And as it turns out, that neither talk nor drugs are the definitive answer to treating post-traumatic stress.
Yeah, and we'll be getting into that further on in the discussion for sure. Yeah. And I did mention the VA, and I had intended to ask you, how did you get into working with trauma? And was it your experience in the VA that got you started? Or
It's meeting Vietnam veterans. The opening scene of my book is meeting a Vietnam veteran who had nightmares, and I had done studies in nightmares, so I gave him a drug to abolish his nightmares. And when I asked him whether he had taken my wonderful medication, he said no, because if my nightmares go away, I will be betraying my friends because I need to be a living memorial to my friends who died in Vietnam.
Wow.
And that statement just bowled me over and made me realize that traumatic stress is a very complex issue, not simple brains, fear circuits or memories or chemicals, but really a very complex identity and social issue as well.
Yeah. Well, that kind of leads to my next question. You've been working with traumatized children and adults for more than 30 years. And what sorts of changes have you seen over that period in terms of both our understanding of trauma and the way that it's dealt with?
Well, we have learned a lot about how trauma affects the brain, how it affects neuropsychological processes, how it impacts on interpersonal relationships, and we have learned a lot about treatment. We have learned that something like EMDR can very successfully resolve the traumatic memories. We have learned that trauma is mainly stored not so much in terms of a story about the past, but as a body that continues to react as if it is in danger. And if it's as if it's helpless, and so the body needs to be worked with in a variety of ways. We have learned the impact of development and the issue of attachment and how disruptions of attachment, as in being separated from your caregivers and being neglected or going to an orphanage, is not the same as being run over by a truck when you're an adult. And so we have learned much more about the very complex adaptations that people have at various ages in response to various forms of disruptions of their lives, etc.
Okay, well, let's step through some of those. You mentioned the brain, and you have a very solid and lengthy discussion of the impact on the brain. So what have recent developments in neuroscience, how have those impacted your understanding of toxic stress and how to treat it? What happens to the brain?
Well, the orientation of the brain has changed in that it gets more oriented to pay attention to sources of threat, and it becomes very difficult to dampen sensations that are related to trauma. So certain images, sounds, physical sensations that are reminiscent of the past set up these rather massive physiological responses. And in order to dampen that, you need to actually calm the body down and to deal with the traumatic memory. So that's one thing. The second thing we discovered is how the whole filtering system of the brain changes. So the brain is more filters in more danger and less pleasure. We have learned how it becomes very hard to pay attention to ordinary stimuli. The brain gets reoriented to deal with threat, but becomes actually quite poor in dealing with day-to-day minor variations of life. So we now understand why it is that traumatized people have such a hard time feeling love, affection, excitement about very ordinary events.
Now, you've done all sorts of research in this area, and I believe you've also done some brain imaging research. What were you studying using that tool, and what did you find?
Well, we did my group and I did the very first neuroimaging study on people having flashbacks.
Uh-huh.
That turned out to be a very interesting study in that we discovered that when people relive their trauma, a fair amount of the brain actually goes offline, particularly in the left anterior prefrontal cortex, where the capacity for analyzing, understanding, and language is located. So essentially, we were able to visualize how people become dumbfounded.
Yeah.
And struck with speechless terror. That was a very big issue. The other thing we discovered or confirmed that when people relive their trauma, their survival brain, their emotional brain becomes very activated, and their frontal lobes, their more rational brain, gets deactivated, so that people sort of quote, take leave of their senses in some ways. And so that people's cognitions fail them when they're on the... We learned that the insula, the part of the brain that's involved in registering and noting what's going on in your body, becomes impaired. So there's a decreased body-mind connection that needs to be reactivated. Various people have discovered that the medial prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain that allows you to feel yourself, notice yourself, and be in touch with yourself, gets quite thrown off track, basically. So it's really hard to notice on what goes on inside of you and to manage what goes on inside of you.
And then I imagine that leads to what gets described as numbing.
Well, initially it starts off as agitation.
Uh-huh.
And feeling frazzled and feeling upset. And so you're at odds with your environment because stuff is always bothering you because your filters don't filter out relevant from irrelevant information. And minor things get you upset, and the little noise that your kids make you blow up. And so you become a very difficult person to live with oftentimes because stuff keeps going wrong. And so the way to deal with that is to, over time, numb yourself down.
Yeah.
And here there's a big difference between if you're a kid who is traumatized or an adult who is traumatized. If you're an adult who is traumatized, you tend to manage these being frazzled, upset, freaked out all the time by external means. So people start taking psychiatric medications, or they start taking drugs, or they start engaging in dangerous activities. So they tend to do things that with which they attempt to manage that feeling frazzled and hyper-aroused all the time. When you're a kid and you're upset, you have one great advantage. You have parents. And if your parents are there for you and they pay attention to you, they can take care of you by rocking you, holding you, reading bedtime stories to you, and hugging you, and all kinds of stuff. That's sort of the natural functions of parents, is to be affect regulators of their kids. And so when kids get upset and traumatized, if you have parents who are there for you, by and large, your relationship with your parents is pretty much can help you to restore your well-being. But if your parents or caregivers are the origin of your threat, then you need to find your own ways of calming yourself down. And that may involve rocking, banging your head against the wall, cutting yourself, chronic masturbation, shutting yourself down on other levels. And so trauma that occurs in the context of attachment relationships has particularly damaging effects on self-regulation issues.
Yeah, yes. It's interesting the way that brain science and attachment theory seem to be reinforcing one another, very synergistic understanding that's developing.
Because the brain is an attachment organ. Uh-huh. I think that oftentimes it gets forgotten by the NIMH and other brain scientists, is that the function of our brain is to hang out together and to get along with each other. The function of the brain is to make us into a social organ. And almost all mental disorders cause disturbances in interpersonal relationships. So the brain is an interpersonal organ. We don't exist as individuals, basically.
Yeah, so that gets into the area of what's being called interpersonal neurobiology.
Yeah.
And so that's contributing to your understanding and work as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's very important part of it.
Yeah.
The big new things that is described in my book, they're just fancy terms, I describe them more simply, is interpersonal neurobiology, how brains and minds and bodies affect each other, and developmental psychopathology, the whole issue that the impact of bad life experiences is different from when you're 2 years old or 8 years old or 12 years old or 30 years old. And as the brain is growing and you don't get seen or comforted or consoled, it has quite profound effects on brain development, actually.
Yeah. So are there actual changes in the brain that are more or less permanent, or are there anatomical changes even?
Well, there's certainly changes that can be regularly seen on neuroimaging, changes in the anterior cingulate, in the corpus callosum, in the amygdala, in the cerebellum, in the periaqueductal gray. And so, yes, you see remarkably different activations of different parts of the brain. And Marty Teicher, my colleague at Harvard, is just beginning to spell out how different forms of trauma have different effects on different parts of the brain. And that eventually will have major impact on treatment, which right now is still too crude to incorporate all these changes, but there are different effects at different times, and if I were running NIMH, I would put most of my money into studying neuroplasticity and see how you can reverse the damage that's been done by abuse, neglect, and other very adverse circumstances, and how you can reverse them and most effectively do that.
Yeah. And you probably have as much of a chance to move things in that direction as anybody, right?
I have about as much as a chance to move things in that direction as you have or any of your listeners.
Come on.
to change that basic orientation that indeed the brain is affected by having to cope with terrible, disruptive stuff, and changes people's capacity to learn, to engage, to get along with other people, is a critical understanding. But I feel like I have not made enough headway with the mainstream of the profession to help people to really incorporate it in their understanding of human beings.
Yeah, so is that one of the hopes for your book? Is that kind of the audience that you primarily had in mind when you wrote your book?
Well, actually, one of my readers on Amazon says, this book should be read by anybody who has an interest in human beings, including themselves. And yes. So that's really what I hope, any person who's interested in human beings will read it, and they'll get something out of it, I'm sure.
Yeah. Now, earlier you mentioned flashbacks, and you have you know, and I think that has to involve memory. And you have a wonderful chapter on memory, and the impact of trauma on memory seems to be really pivotal. So you start off by referring to Freud and Charcot and their work on hysteria. Maybe you can take us through what they got right and what they got wrong.
I think they got most things right. I mean, they were smart people. The person you shouldn't leave out is Pierre Janet, who was the first person to really spell it all out. But all these guys understood is the nature of trauma is that at some point the mind becomes overwhelmed and can just not take in what's happening, integrate what's happening, and that at the core of a traumatic experience is an element of dissociation. That the brain cannot integrate the experience and it stays on in the mind as unpleasant sensations, intense emotional disruptions, images that keep coming back, behaviors that get repeated, but the real lack of integration of body-mind functioning. And both Janet and Breuer and Freud back in 1893 wrote spectacular papers about it that basically from beginning to end are accurate representations of what happens in traumatized people.
Yeah, you gave some wonderful quotes from the work in your book, and reading the quotes, I thought, wow, that sounds so contemporary.
Oh yeah, yeah, no, these guys got it. I mean, they're not necessarily less smart than we are today. You know, like we haven't become more intelligent; we just have better technology today.
Yeah,
to explain things, but in terms of clinical observations, these guys were as good as anybody who's ever been around. And that is really the disintegration of memory. And all of these guys talked about it. The treatment of traumatic stress is to integrate these memories and help people with feeling these memories in an organized and quiet ways so they can begin to experience them as something belonging to the past rather than to in the present. And that's important. Very hard to argue with.
Yeah, and the emphasis that they gave to that it wasn't just a recounting, but it had to be a recounting with feeling and engagement. And that seems to me to line up very well with some contemporary research on memory.
Although our research shows is that just being able to recount it with affect doesn't necessarily resolve the traumatic stress.
Yeah, and that's fascinating. I was really impressed reading your discussion of repressed traumatic memories and the way that that tide has shifted one way and the other over time. And that up until recently, that was a huge debate. And now it seems like it's more or less a closed door. The tide has really turned against the notion that traumatic memories can be repressed. In fact, several of my past guests have come out strongly asserting that science has shown that to be a myth and that courtroom defenses based on that phenomenon are no longer accepted. Yet your research shows just the opposite. This is a topic with enough juice that we could develop a whole interview on it.
No, as long as people have seen, worked with, and dealt with trauma, they're always impressed with how the traumatic memory goes offline in many people. And every study that has ever studied a traumatic population has found it, except one study in which people studied parents who had seen their kids being murdered. Apparently that didn't go underground for anybody, but anybody who studies wars or car accidents or rapes or certainly child abuse finds that a certain proportion of people forget their memories. It's an incontrovertible issue. So, and certainly, I testified in federal courts several times about it, and they accepted the notion of repressed memory. So, don't believe those people who tell you that repressed memory doesn't occur. It's an essential part of trauma. Is also part of the DSM in all its lack of wisdom, recognizes the existence of dissociative amnesia.
Yeah, I was impressed by the way that you went back and you looked at records of people who had been in concentration camps during the Second World War, and the painfulness of the memories and their reluctance to both their inability to effectively remember in a coherent, sequential way the events, and also the intense avoidance and resistance to remembering that stuff. And then you go on to point out how, in your view, there's even a cultural resistance to looking at that, so that there's this kind of swing in terms of the acceptance of coming to terms with that this is a phenomenon that happens to people.
Well, you see, people like to chat about vacations and unpleasant things, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about trauma. We're talking about seeing somebody blown up in front of your face. You talk about being gang-raped, stuff like that. And so we're talking about things that completely overwhelm a human being. Yeah. And when you hear it and you see it, and you experience it, you go, oh my God, nobody could possibly survive this and come out on the other side. So this is not about unpleasant stuff. This is not like burning your potatoes. This is about horror. Yeah. And the brain is not capable of taking in and digesting horror in a neutral way. And so the moment you start going there, your brain becomes overwhelmed. And what a good part of neuroscience is that you see how different parts of the brain just get knocked out as you get into a state of horror. The bigger issue to me is how society doesn't want to take trauma into account. We have this big debate about black kids getting killed by the police all the time, getting stopped by the police all the time. And the people say, oh, it's not so bad, it doesn't matter. But if you're a little kid growing up and you get constantly stopped by the police and your friends get killed in that process, that is really has quite an impact. And, you know, and the same thing like before the U.S. invaded Iraq. There's no discussion about what would happen to these soldiers who would go to war. Even though we know from every previous war that's been studied that a very substantial number of people who go off to work come back and become alcoholics and become drug addicts and become unemployed and commit suicide. So any of that stuff that's coming out today with the Iraqi and Afghani veterans is very old news. That was totally expectable. So what is more concerning to me is the false memory syndrome of the media and of mainstream organizations that keeps ignoring the effect of trauma and doesn't inculcate it in our school systems, in the military, and in the way we lead our lives.
And how about the political decision makers? I mean, before we went into Iraq, I was practically tearing my hair out saying, don't they remember Vietnam? This is looking like Vietnam all over again.
Exactly. So I would call that a false memory syndrome.
Okay.
And people keep, that's how society parallels the lives of victims. And as they keep doing the same stupid stuff over and over again, unable to learn from experience.
Yeah.
And that's true for traumatized people who grow up with an alcoholic father, who they were horrified by and loved at the same time, have a tendency to fall in love with alcoholic guys who then need to be saved. And so people have this astounding compulsion to repeat a trauma that, of course, Freud was also interested in. And society keeps repeating the trauma over and over again. Until we learn. Another important motivation for me to write this book.
Yeah. And I think to a large degree, your impulse to write the book was also to critique some of the mainstream treatments for PTSD today in this country. So tell us, what are the mainstream treatments and how effective are they?
Well, actually, I'm not a modest person. I think I am mainstream.
Okay. You think you're mainstream? Okay.
When you get to talk to 50,000 people per year, as I do, it's not unreasonable to claim that you have your own part of the mainstream.
Yes. But what about that other part that you are critical of?
Well, you know, I think people need to figure out for themselves what works and doesn't work. And I'm just, my book is not a polemic against other people. My book is about what we know about trauma in the brain and development and how we can treat it.
Yeah, that's true. It's definitely not a polemic against other people or approaches. So let me ask you specifically, what about the use of drugs and the treatment of PTSD, and how effective are they?
They can be helpful. They can make it a little bit less intense. They don't cure trauma, but it can help people sleep sometimes, or some days make people a little bit less depressed or a little bit more engaged. It doesn't resolve the trauma. And the other interesting thing about psychiatric drugs is that when we do our studies in civilian populations, we get about a 30% drop in their symptoms. No, it's not great, but it's somewhat helpful. But almost every study on military populations have been failed studies. So there's something about combat trauma that doesn't seem to respond to medications very well. And somehow the VA and the Department of Defense seem not to have read those studies that show that medications really aren't very effective for PTSD in soldiers and veterans. The other big issue is the use of drugs in traumatized kids. And that is really a very important issue, because I consider that one of our major public health issues in this country, in that over 500,000 kids are taking antipsychotic agents. And the poorer you are, and the more you go from foster home to foster home, and the more you are on Medicaid as opposed to private insurance, the more likely it is that you'll get drugs to control your behavior. And that's a very, very alarming trend that we need to have a much more public discussion about, because these drugs really interfere with the capacity of kids to be curious, to be motivated, and to engage in relationships with other people. So I think we're raising hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of kids whose prognosis to become healthy adults is, in fact, impaired by the drugs we give them rather than help. So that's a very big issue.
Yes, it is. And what about cognitive behavioral therapy and exposure therapy, which I gather is very big, particularly in the VA?
Right. Well, cognitive behavioral therapy is very useful for people who have cognition. And so if you can think and reflect on yourself, it's a very good treatment. What the research shows over and over again is that when you go into these traumatic modes, your cognition goes offline.
Yeah.
For example, like anger management classes are wonderful as long as you don't get angry. Because the moment you get angry, that whole cognition of, oh, this is what it means and this is what I should do, tends to sort of go offline. And so the trauma is not a cognitive issue. It's not a result of being stupid or not being able to have a proper perspective on life. It's not that part of the brain. And trauma sits in your survival brain, where your brain automatically gets triggered into feeling like you are under threat and that you are in danger and that life is almost over. And so it's a different part of the brain. And so cognitive behavioral treatment is for one part of the brain, but it doesn't work in the part of the brain where trauma mainly has its impact.
Yeah, that seems like a major point.
That is a major point, yeah.
Yeah, and I would think that's the message, one of the very important messages that really needs to get out there.
Yeah, but I imagine sooner or later people can figure it out for themselves. I mean, when your patients keep not getting better or have only a 10% improvement, sooner or later, I hope you say, I wonder if I can do better than this.
Yeah.
And the other thing that's important here is that another piece that of neuroscience research shows that sort of the relational yakking part of the brain, which is on both sides of your brain, can be very helpful for like conversation that you and I are having, which is sort of this social brain.
Yeah.
It's very nice for us to talk about things and dispute things and set up programs and cook Christmas dinner and stuff like that. But that part of the brain doesn't change the deeper structures of the brain where the trauma actually sits. And so the only structure of the brain that we know, of your consciousness that we know can change your deep survival issues is the medial prefrontal cortex, we call in neuroscience, the midline structures of the brain. I call it the mohawk of the brain that runs from just above your eyes all the way to the back through the middle of your brain. And that's the part of your brain that's devoted to self observation and self-reflection. And it turns out that the only part of your consciousness that can change these deeper structures is the self-reflective part of the brain. And so the issue of mindfulness, mindful observing yourself, mindful noticing of yourself, is an essential element of beginning to deal with trauma.
Uh-huh.
So you cannot really deal with trauma unless you develop some sort of commitment to observe yourself and to notice yourself and to spend time with yourself in silence.
Uh-huh. Now, I wonder if you're familiar with Philip Zimbardo's work on trauma, suggesting that individuals suffering from PTSD need to be trained to shift their time perspective from focusing on the past to focusing on the present and the future. That might relate to what you just said.
It's familiar, but that sounds a little cognitive to me.
Right.
Again, so it is not a cognitive issue, but learning to sit still, observe yourself, meditation, yoga, mindfulness is central because indeed, when you're traumatized, your brain is oriented towards reliving the past and the past comes into the present. And, I have a lot of data throughout the book about various brain things that go wrong and keep you in the past. But indeed, it becomes very hard to focus in the present. And so people should not be admonished to be in the present because if you see what actually happens in people's brains, you know that their brain actually is not very geared towards being in the present. Like your prefrontal cortex doesn't have a lot of high beta waves that make it possible for you to be very focused on what's going on. So rather than admonishing people, they need to be helped to do that. And so one way of doing that is with something like neurofeedback, where you can actually retrain people's brain waves in order for people to be focused on the present and to be to be still and to be attentive. You can also train these issues by helping people to just be very focused on the moment with things like martial arts or drumming or yoga, where your body just has to pay attention to what's going on right now. So admonishing people, I think, is I have a rule for that in my office, is that if I admonish my patients, I don't charge for the sessions.
Okay, that's good.
So the job is for us as clinicians who get paid for doing this work is to actually have tools in our toolbox that can help our patients to do so.
Yeah, that somehow is reminding me of stories about traditional Chinese doctors or healers who would get paid only as long as people were healthy. So I don't know if that's really true or not.
I think that's a good idea, basically. It would mean that I would not have been able to raise my kids because for the first 15 years after my training, I basically didn't know anything about how to treat people. So that means to you that therapists usually don't get any income till about 20 years after they finish their training.
Okay. What's your opinion of efforts in the U.S. military to put all soldiers through some sort of resilience training?
Well, I got into trouble about it. I think, again, thinking cheerful thoughts does not really undo the images of people being blown up, killing people, seeing your best friends being killed, seeing these horrendous things and participating in horrendous things. I mean, as I said on PBS at one point, this is Dale Carnegie meeting the killing fields. I mean, it doesn't quite work that way.
Yeah, even I think there's even an ethical concern. Do we want to have soldiers that are in some way robotic and immune to the horrors that they're involved in?
Well, you know, that's really, of course, what it's all about, to go to war and to kill other people and not get killed yourself. That is the purpose of the military. And so their job is to create people who can do that and who do not come home wounded. So that's their job. So it becomes a political issue whether you want to continue to be a country that does that all the time. So that is a political issue. Of course, the military is very good in training people like that. Basic training is an extraordinarily effective psychological treatment to help very disorganized, all over the place kids become very well-trained soldiers who are very good at what they do. And so I think the military really figured it out about how to change people's brains in order to get very focused in the present and to become a very effective fighting force. Now I wish they would become just as good in detraining people to become involved in civilian life and to be totally focused on their civilian life. And the methods may actually have some similarity to the methods of basic training.
Huh, that's an interesting concept to have. I'm picturing a basic training camp for a period of either some weeks or months at the end of military service, instead of people jumping on a plane and suddenly finding themselves back in society, that there would be a period, kind of as you suggest, a boot camp that really gets them ready for all that.
Yeah, that's just part of the picture, of course, because, again, the military is only 10% of our overall national trauma. So it's still a relatively small population, even though lots of the resources go there.
Uh-huh. Is it reasonable to talk about a cure for PTSD, or is it more of a condition that the best one can hope for is to somehow develop an accommodation to it?
And as you can read from my book, and every treatment chapter has a number of cases in there and some research background in most of them, even though not all of them, that show that people got cured from their trauma. So at the end, my book is a very hopeful book that shows that if you really apply the resources and the knowledge we have about PTSD, it's very likely that people can recover to a very large degree, if not fully.
Okay. Now, you end up recommending elements from ancient practices such as yoga, tai chi, drumming, and drama. I'm wondering, how did you first get on to this? And you know, maybe you're just a guy like me, you know, who came up through the 60s, and so all this stuff seems like a good idea.
Well, you know, our field is whether you grew up in the 60s or grew up as a scientist, life is a question of experimental efforts. And so you see what works. And if something doesn't work, you try something else. And when you learn a piece of information about how the brain works or how trauma affects people, you need to apply that piece of information to see what the implications are. For example, when you find out that people with PTSD have brainwave patterns similar to that of ADHD, which makes it very hard to focus, then you need to examine how can we help people to focus. And then when it turns out that drugs may not be the best way, it turns out that maybe helping people to play computer games with their own brainwaves and change their brainwaves that way might be more effective. So that is a big part of our research effort, is to establish the validity of neurofeedback as an effective treatment for PTSD, which we certainly find is the case. In our most recent data that came out after the book was finished, actually, we showed that neurofeedback can dramatically enhance executive functioning in people. I don't know anything else that does that. When you learn that people who are traumatized have poor heart rate variability, i.e. Some brainstem issues that your guest Stephen Porges has talked to you on your program, and you find that they have very poor arousal modulation secondary to brainstem issues, then you need to figure out how you can increase people's heart rate variability. And that led us to studying heart math, and that got us involved in yoga.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you see that the midline structures of the brain that have to do with self-observation and somatic awareness get knocked out in chronically traumatized people. You have no choice but to start exploring what particular methods can help people to have more of a relationship to their internal world, their visceral world, and you get into somatic type therapies.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned neurofeedback, and that's a bit different than biofeedback, and I want my listeners to be aware of that. So maybe you could say something about the difference between neurofeedback and biofeedback.
Well, it's all feedback. So in biofeedback, you feedback people's heart rate or skin conductance, and you get a different level of arousal through peripheral means. In neurofeedback, you actually harvest people's brainwaves, and you can actually analyze their brainwave patterns with something called a quantitative EEG, and you can see what part of the brain is not properly talking to other parts of the brain, and you can actually help people to reconnect those brain areas and brainwaves through feedback.
Yeah, another approach that you extol the benefits of is EMDR. What do you see as the mechanism by which it impacts traumatic memories?
Oh, I love that question, because that's a very good question. Of course, we know exactly how Prozac changes people, and then we know exactly how talking changes people. So it's interesting that people always ask, so how does EMDR work? But they don't ask, so how does talking work? How relationships work? And so throughout the book, actually, I do try to address the issues of how does Prozac actually work, and how does talking work? And how does talking change the brain, which is a much more mysterious thing, actually, than EMDR. EMDR seems to work by activating 40 megahertz thalamocortical rhythms, which are the same rhythms that you experience during REM sleep, during your dream sleep, that helps the brain to process daytime residues and moves it from the sensory area of the cortex into the thalamus, into the prefrontal cortex.
Oh, that's interesting. I had not heard EMDR explained with that at that neurological level. So that's very interesting. And let's see here. What do you wish that more people understood about trauma?
That telling people not to be scared or telling people to behave makes them only more scared and makes them only feel more alienated. And I wish that people would understand more that trauma is the result of horror, horrendous experiences. And the only way to overcome that is to help people to feel completely and totally safe, at least for some moments. And that the brain needs to be helped to be calm and safe in order to reconstruct and reprocess the things that have gone online, offline at the time of the horrendous experience.
Okay, well, that could be our wrap-up there, but maybe is there anything else that you'd like to add by way of summary?
Yeah, you know, it's something that I don't need to tell you because I'm sure you're aware of it, but that we are relational people and that relationships in which we feel safe, in which we can say what we want to say, in which we can safely explore what's going on inside of us, in which we are not being prescribed to behave in a particular way, but are invited to really get to know ourselves. That's very central. You know, trauma is about being unable to be too overwhelmed to know what you know and to feel what you feel. And the treatment of trauma is to making it safe for people to know what to know, to feel what they feel.
Okay, well, I really want to thank you, Dr. Bessel van der Kolk, for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's a pleasure talking with you.
I feel very privileged to have had this opportunity to speak with Dr. Bessel van der Kolk. It seems to me that he's one of the key players in the world of trauma and PTSD studies. He has the unique vantage point of being both a researcher himself and a clinician. His chapter on the whole debate about repressed memories resulting from trauma is probably worth the price of the book in itself. Supposedly, that debate is over, but in my mind, he certainly has opened it up again. As a result of reading Dr. van der Kolk's book, and it really underscores the difference between what can be shown to be true in the lab versus what is discovered to be true in the field. For me, it also underscores issues around evidence-based therapies. I'm all for science and for bringing as much evidence to the practice of psychotherapy as possible. However, at the same time, I believe that clinical experience has to be regarded as a legitimate source of evidence as well, and not just that evidence that can be developed in experimental studies. I think Dr. van der Kolk was being maybe a little bit disingenuous when he parried my remark about him being in a good position to help change some of the policies and approaches that are considered to be mainstream today. The basis for my remark, among other things, is that he is head of the Trauma Center in Boston, one of the capitals of medical authority in the nation, if not the world, and he is also the director of the National Child Traumatic Stress Network. So I think these roles, as well as his stature as a researcher, position him ideally as a force to be reckoned with. I may have seemed facetious as well in my remark that the treatment approaches that he finds most effective include such things as mindfulness, meditation, yoga, drumming, psychodrama, tai chi, and so on. Personally, I believe he's on solid ground in moving us toward treatment approaches that more fully integrate the body. And so my remark about those approaches, perhaps coming out of the 60s, may have seemed to be lighthearted. But I do believe that we are both pretty much of that generation, and to me it exemplifies an observation I've shared in the past that as our generation has come into power in academia and practice, we've been able to implement ideas that would have seemed too much on the fringe to our elders when we were coming up. This conversation with Dr. van der Kolk brought to mind my interview with Dr. Edward Tick way back in 2007, which was titled War and the Soul. I was tempted to ask Dr. van der Kolk if he was familiar with Dr. Tick's work, but I didn't want to put him on the spot if he wasn't aware of it. I think he'd find much to agree with in Dr. Tick's approach, which included group process work grounded in Native American traditions and rituals, including drumming, as I recall. You heard Dr. van der Kolk say that trauma is so widely spread in our country that everyone could benefit from reading his book. I have to agree, and I definitely recommend his book, The Body Keeps the Score, to you all. And as always, let me remind you that you can order it using our Amazon.com widget in the right-hand sidebar on the Shrink Wrap Radio website.
Hello, Dr. Dave. It's Claire Edwards from the Sunshine Coast of Queensland, Australia here. I work as a facilitator and coach specializing in neuroleadership and positive psychology. Dr. Dave and your Shrink Wrap Radio form an integral part of my continued professional development. Being based in Australia, it's so convenient for me just to download the podcast and listen at a time convenient to me. I also really enjoy the breadth of experts and the wide range of opinions, which helps me form my own conclusions. Dr. Dave, thanks again for providing such a valuable, insightful, and value-added service.
Thank you, Claire Edwards. You wonderful Aussies show so much appreciation and intelligence. It really buoys my spirits during this holiday time. I do hope others will feel similarly as you do, and in that regard, I should mention that I've received notice from PayPal that a number of listeners' donations have failed. I think the reason is that they have received updated credit cards and failed to let PayPal know. I just had one of my main cards updated by Visa, and I needed to contact about 10 different payees of the updated expiry date and code. So check to see if something like that might be happening for you. You're getting this on New Year's Day, and what better way to start the new year than resolving to help support my work here at shrinkwrapradio.com. If you're not already doing so, do it now. Go to shrinkwrapradio.com and click on the big support button in the right-hand sidebar. You'll feel great that you did, and you'll start your new year off with a very warm feeling. And so will I. I have a bunch of new announcements for you. I have two new continuing education courses through the Zur Institute. I think this first one I announced last time. It's holistic and nutritional approaches to treating psychological disorders for 5 continuing education units. And the course description says, as the old mind-body dichotomy continues to dissolve, psychotherapists are becoming increasingly aware that diagnosing and treating mental disorders requires a broader perspective than the DSM and many graduate courses present. Common disorders such as depression, anxiety, obsessive-compulsive disorders, ADHD, and many others, if not all of them, are intertwined with physical symptoms and even physical causes. Treatment for these disorders can benefit greatly from a complementary/holistic perspective that takes into account such factors as diet, nutrition, and exercise. But here's our very newest one, and it also is a holistic approach. The course is called Holistic Psychotherapy, Treating the Whole Person, and this one is worth 6 continuing education units. And you know that increasingly psychotherapists are recognizing that we cannot separate the mind and body in treatment, and that adopting a holistic perspective leads to more effective modes of psychotherapy. Exercise, proper nutrition, hypnosis, and other relaxation techniques, EMDR, and acupressure, all support the notion that psychological disorders and their treatment involve a complex interaction between mind and body. Yet psychology has also seen its share of quackery and fads, and so it's also important to employ critical thinking, to utilize treatments that have solid empirical support, and make sure that practitioners are trained well and qualified to perform the modalities they employ. Now, of course, both of these courses are based on selected Shrink Wrap Radio interviews with authorities in the field, plus a resources page for each course. All you need to do is to listen to the interviews, and maybe you already have, and answer some relatively simple true-false questions. Moreover, you can now get a 10% discount on any of these courses offered through the Zur Institute by using the discount code Dr. Dave 88, and that's spelled, and the case does not matter, DRDAVE, numeral 8. And speaking of discounts, our strategic partner, the Jung Platform, is also offering a discount on a course on alchemy with Jungian analysts Robbie Bosnack and Patricia Berry, both of whom you've heard me interview previously, and so you know how fascinating they are, and we only scratched the surface. The 10 sessions of this course are spread out over 2 years. You can attend the 10 live webinar sessions, but you'll also receive an audio recording of each session. So if you miss one of the kind of in-person webinars, you'll still be able to catch up with the DVD. You'll find the dates and other details on our Shrink Wrap Radio website under the Partners tab. And the cost of the course is $150 for this 2-year course, but you can receive 15% off by using the discount code simply Dr. Dave. And this time it's D-R-D-A-V-E, and that's it. I'm sure you enjoyed today's interview with Dr. Bessel van der Kolk. I think his book is a terribly important addition to the literature on the healing of trauma. Once again, the title is The Body Keeps the Score, Brain, Mind, and Body in the Healing of Trauma. And as luck would have it, this wonderful and important book is available on audible.com. And if you're not already a subscriber to audible.com, it can be yours for free to keep with no obligation to continue your subscription. It can be yours just by going to audibletrial.com/shrink, or you can get any one of their other 165,000 titles.
I've been laying on this couch, babe. I've been laying here so long, just waiting for Dr. Dave, babe, to play his shrink wrap radio song. Oh, he plays it so sweet and he plays it so warm. Shrink wrap radio, it's a harbor from the storm. You know he speaks to your mind, babe, but he's really speaking to your soul. Talking shrink wrap radio, babe. You know that's just the way that he rolls. At the end of the day, you know what you'll find. Like Dr. Dave said, it's all in your mind.
Thanks, Fake Bob. It's been a while since we've heard that one. Now let's take a quick dip into the old email bag. And this first one is from Tony in Melbourne, who writes, Dr. Dave, still listening, still gardening, still loving your work. Eternally grateful. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And that's from Tony J. in Melbourne, Australia. And Tony, thank you so much, and keep on gardening, keep on listening. And this next one is from Chaz, who writes, Dr. Dave, I wanted to write and let you know the important effect your podcast has on my practice. Not only is this information incredible, but I find myself truly energized in my practice after listening to the podcast. I consider myself to be a passionate learner in the field of psychotherapy, and few things contribute more to my learning than the information I pick up in your interviews. I cannot thank you enough for the work you do. As a psychotherapist and professor, I'm always humbled to hear the amazing work being done in the name of psychology and therapy. I will continue to listen intently every week, and hopefully I can do something interesting someday to get a chance to be a guest. Thank you for everything, and that's from Chaz Frank, who is a licensed clinical social worker and I gather a professor somewhere. And he has a PS, as an avid reader, I was curious, what are some things on your, quotes, essential reading list? Well, Chaz, first of all, I'm glad to hear from another professor and therapist out there that you get so much out of this show. Of course, that makes me very happy. And in terms of the essential reading, I would need you to narrow it down perhaps a bit. Are we talking psychology? Are we talking psychotherapy? Are we talking fiction, nonfiction? What are we talking? In terms of psychology / psychotherapy, you know, most of the people I interview are authors, and I'm very enthusiastic about some more than others. And a good place to start would be to look at the Best of Shrink Wrap Radio, a list of podcasts that I kind of consider to be among my best. And they're arranged more or less topically, and I need to update that list probably a little bit. But why don't you take a look at that? It's in the left-hand sidebar, and it says Best of SRR. And I hope people will understand that SRR stands for Shrink Wrap Radio. So with that, we better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemail on our message phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks again to Dr. Bessel van der Kolk, MD, for sharing his insights into healing from trauma. My next show will be on embracing envy in life and in therapeutic practice with John Gressel, PhD, a San Francisco-based psychotherapist. So I hope you'll join me then. And this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.